What's up, Wildside besties and baddies? I'm Bailey.
And I'm Chelsea, and we're here to walk you through the wild sides.
From homicides to hosticides and everything in between.
We're so glad you're here, so buckle up
and enjoy the ride. Welcome to the Wildside Podcast. We're no longer a true crime podcast. We are an emotionally
blubbering
mess. Chelsea and I just had a family therapy session with just her and me, talking about all of the functional and dysfunctional parts of our beloved family system. So glad you could be here, Wildsiders. So we're going to take a deep dive into family therapy.
Yes. Hey, also,
just kidding. We're not.
Did you know that zebras and horses are not the same, but they're very, very similar, and they can actually breed with each other, and they would produce either a Hebra or a Zorse?
Didn't know that.
Mm-mm. No, like I'm not being sarcastic or trying to be funny.
No,
like
I believe you.
Literal thing, and it depends on if the zebra is male or female. Let's think here. If the male is a horse and the female is a zebra, then they produce Hebras, and the opposite is true, and they would produce Zorses.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
And I just want you to know that I love you so much that I took a gamble on buying from probably, like, you know, a virus-filled Chinese website.
Oh, yes.
I got you something, and I just found out today that it was actually delivered 2 weeks ago to Kissimmee, Florida, so you're not going to ever get it. But I want you to know what my gift was. It was going to be for your birthday. I found...
Oh, I remember you saying, like, you have the best thing ever. I got you the best thing ever for your birthday. And I was like, is it a new back? And you were like, oh.
No.
Okay, maybe the second.
It was the shirt that Ty wore in Clueless with her makeover, the heart shirt.
Yes.
I found one because the maker who made that for the movie, I think she had like a boutique in LA or something. And I found there was like none of them anywhere. I've scoured the whole web for it. And I found one that they made in like some boutique in supposedly, I don't know, like China. And I was like, it's the best $47 that I'm going to probably never see again. But I just want you to know that you would have had that and it would have been epic.
Well, who do I need to meet up with in Kissimmee, Florida?
I have no idea. Like, even when I tried to go back to the website to, like, you know, hey, click here if you need to make questions about your order, I literally got a message window pop up that's like uninterested site. So I don't know if I want to take that risk twice.
Well, and really, it could, I mean, hopefully they didn't deliver it to a real person in Kissimmee, Florida, but it might have been anthrax. Like, you might have saved me from having anthrax.
Yeah, or somebody randomly got Ty's t-shirt from her makeover in Clueless. Yeah.
Because I am Ty, because she was born in May and Megan was born in April, and that's why we were best friends, and that's why the people in Clueless were best friends.
Mm-hmm. So I just want you to know that that's what that is. And so far, you guys, we've gotten a couple people being like, yes, Bailey, you should be interviewed. But I'm not convinced that that speaks for the masses. So if y'all are serious about it, you have to communicate with us, whether it's on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, whatever the case is. And then we'll make a decision if it actually speaks for the masses or not.
Come on, guys. You know you want to. It'd be super fun. And it's really not scary. Maybe you've been debating, like, should I put myself out there? This is your sign. You in the yellow t-shirt watching Clueless.
That's right.
On our show.
That's right. So we can't promise you guys that we're not going to cry throughout this episode because Chelsea and I are already emotionally charged, and this is an emotionally charged case.
Oh, man. Yeah, it's a day. If it were a Monday, it would be just another manic Monday.
Whoa. Yeah, and so this is interview week. This is going to be Dr. A's interview week.
Ooh, I thoroughly enjoyed Dr. A as well. Ooh.
And Lauren.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man, yes. Lauren works with Dr. A or under Dr. A in their crime lab.
essentially yet.
The research lab.
The research lab.
That's correct. Really, really just, again, so fascinating.
Yeah. So this week we're going to be specifically talking about false confessions.
Oh, man. Here we go. Falsely confessing. Just so everybody knows, if the first thought that you have is, I would not falsely confess, I would put that thought on pause and just hold on to your biscuits.
Yep. Yeah. And so this is a case that has to do with child stuff. And I don't like child stuff a whole lot. That's why I haven't covered
really
it.
I don't like child stuff.
But it's a, I think this is a good example of what we're going to be walking into with Dr. A's interview this week. So, you ready, Chels?
I'm here for it.
All right, so we're going to start with a background with the family, and then we're going to take lots of loops and turns as we progress throughout this episode, okay? So, this case starts in a small town of Wilmington, Illinois. So, we are up north, Midwest for this episode, and Wilmington is just about south of Joliet, and it's about 50 miles southwest of Chicago. So Wilmington, Illinois is a town that stands in a rural stretch of old Route 66 and is considered to be the epitome of Midwestern America. Kevin Fox grew up with his brother and parents in Wilmington, Illinois. And Wilmington had been home to the family for four generations. Kevin was described as a small town boy who was regarded as gentle, kind, and a family man. Now, when Kevin got in high school, he met his soon-to-be wife, Melissa Rossi, at a high school volleyball game. How, like, American is this so far?
I was going to say, little ditty about Jack and Diane, about Kevin and Melissa. Two American boys doing the best that they can.
It really sums it up. And so Melissa had moved with her family to Wilmington when she was in the third grade, after her father was diagnosed with cancer. They wanted to find like a peaceful town where they could spend quality time while he was alive. And so Kevin, he graduated high school, went to college at Illinois State, and Melissa and Kevin soon found out they were expecting. So by 2004, Melissa and Kevin had a six-year-old son, Tyler, and a three-year-old daughter, Riley.
Okay.
By all outward appearances, the Foxes were a hardworking small-town family just trying to make a good life for themselves. Just like he said.
Doing the best that they can.
And so one weekend in June of 2004, Melissa left Wilmington and headed to Chicago with some friends to participate in the Avon Walk for Cancer. She wanted to do this because it was a way to represent her dad, who by this time he had passed away from cancer. And it was the first time she'd ever spent the night away from her kids. Right?
What do you think of when you think of Avon, the Avon lady?
Edward Scissorhands, 1,000%.
Edward Scissorhands. Every single time with him having all those different creams on.
Avon lady. And so while Melissa went to Chicago to go on this walk, Kevin stayed home with the kids. And on Saturday, Melissa ended up staying with her friends at a campsite in Skokie. And Kevin had dropped the kids off with his mother-in-law, Sandy. So he dropped the kids off with his mother-in-law. He went with a friend to Chicago to attend a concert with a friend and his brother-in-law. After the concert, the three men left and drove home. Kevin first...
Do we know what type of concert it was? Because if it was a Sister Hazel concert, then that
might have
been the precursor to something real bad. Like the microphones.
No, I don't know what concert it was. I don't.
Bummer.
But when Kevin got home, he stopped by his mother-in-law Sandy's house to pick up the kids, Tyler and Riley, and then headed home, and they got home about 1 in the morning. Exhausted from the drive and the concert, Kevin noted that he was too tired to make up the beds for the kids, so he let the kids sleep in the living room, which, yeah, happens, no big deal.
Sure.
Tyler slept on a chair with a footstool, and Riley slept on the couch. He locked the front door and retired to his room and went to bed. Early the next morning, the oldest son, Tyler, woke up Kevin, telling him that Riley is gone.
Well, again, you ran away from home one time when you were like two. Do you
remember? I remember.
Oh, yeah. You were going to go to Grammy's house.
and get chocolate milk because my mother Brenda wouldn't give it to me. She wouldn't enable me.
She wouldn't enable you. So you
Grammy would have.
Yeah. So you're like, I know exactly how to get to Grammy's house from my house. I'm 2 years old.
Yeah.
Here I go.
And I remember this really nice woman came up to me and picked me up and took me to her house and put a sweater on me because I was just in a diaper. And she was like, do you know your phone number? And I remember being like, bitch, I don't know my phone number even when at that age. And the next thing I know, I'm sitting in the front of a police car and mom's there and Grandma Janie's there and everybody's panicking. And that's back in the day when the cops were like, hey, I'm glad you're here. Here's your kid, before like CPS was called.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that was a guardian angel, I believe. Mm-hmm. So
yeah. So I mean, as far as kids not being in the house all of a sudden, it happens.
It happens.
It really, yeah. really, really does. Like, no judgment and for kids slipping
yeah.
out.
Yeah. It happens. And so Kevin, who is trying not to panic, right? So he first searches the house. Well, she could have gone to her room. She could have gone here. He immediately noticed that the front door and the screen were ajar. And so he was like, she may have walked out of the house and gone next door because that's where her best friend lived.
Sure.
So he went next door, asked the neighbors, but they hadn't seen Riley.
Oh, gosh.
There is no sign of her anywhere. So in quick succession, he called his wife, Melissa, who immediately left Chicago and headed home. And then he called the Wilmington Police Department. When officers arrived to the Fox's home, Kevin told police that Riley was wearing a t-shirt with a pink flamingo on it and pink capri pants. They assured him that they would immediately begin looking for her, but reassured him that try not to panic because in a lot of these cases, the kids just kind of wander off and we can't find them at first, just like you said.
Remind me one more time, how old is Riley?
She's three.
She's three. Okay.
She's three. And so word quickly began to spread in the neighborhood and in the town that three-year-old Riley Fox was missing, and the community came together to begin a search. In less than an hour, just about the entire community was involved in the search for Riley.
Wow.
And so pretty quickly, the case of the missing toddler began to catch attention locally and then nationally. Huh. An Amber Alert was sent out and flashed across televisions everywhere. And as a matter of fact, Kevin's brother Chad got a call from somebody who was watching the Cubs game that was just like, hey, isn't this your niece?
Oh, wow.
And so people were just like, oh, this is Riley. What is going on? And so it happened really quickly. Volunteers from the community set up stations of food, refreshments for the volunteers searching for the little girl.
Hey, real quick, because I had somebody ask me this past week, is there a time limit that you have to wait before you report a person missing? Do you know if you have to wait like 24 hours or if you can report it immediately? Do you know how that works?
I honestly don't know. I think that might have been the rule of thumb, you know, a while back, but I think there's no time limit to it now, at least if they're a minor, from my understanding. I could be wrong though, I'm not sure.
Yeah, we'll have to look that up. That's kind of what I said. I was like, I don't think there's a time limit anymore. I don't think they have to, like, well, when they've been gone for 24 hours, call us back. Because I know at a time it was kind of like, well, you know,
yeah, they're probably runaways. Or,
yeah, unless it's 24 to 48 hours, we really, you know, there's really no need to report.
It might be the case for adults, but I think for minors, it's different. But okay. I could be wrong.
Yeah.
So by that afternoon, more than 500 people were scouring the area and were using every mode available. There were people on horses, bicycles, all-terrain vehicles, on foot, searching neighborhoods, the woods around the home, everything. And by about 3 p.m., the energy in the community shifted when Melissa and Kevin saw law enforcement officers jump into their cars and speed off all in one direction.
Mm.
Can you imagine?
You know, I think what has been another, maybe in the negative side of things, surprising on doing a podcast like this, I feel like it's bringing and unlocking a lot of my fears that I maybe have not put as much thought into.
Yeah.
And the, like, reviewing these cases and listening to it, I am like, oh, congratulations, that's another fear of mine.
Oh, yeah.
Unlocked.
Yeah, absolutely. And according to an article by Brian Smith, and huge shout out to Brian Smith because he did a bomb.com job on this article about this whole situation. And I'm going to bring him up several times, but there's a lot of sources mixed in. So according to his article, about a mile away from the Fox's home,
a local mother-daughter search team had decided to search Forsyth Woods, which was a dense forest preserve and public park.
Mm-hmm.
The mother of the searching duo had made her way to the edge of the Forked Creek when she noticed something that looked like a plastic bag. She screamed when she realized what she had found. The Will County Sheriff's Department had taken charge, assuming jurisdiction because the crime scene was in a forest preserve, and within minutes, a Wilmington crime scene investigator arrived to the scene. Okay, trigger alert. This is going to be some not so fun stuff about children, okay? And I hate it so much. So what this woman had found was the body of Riley. Riley was floating face down in the water. She was wearing her pink flamingo t-shirt, and she was covered in mud and silt. She was found without her underwear or capri pants.
Oh, gosh.
She had bruising on her head. Her mouth had been covered in duct tape, and adhesive residue was on her arms, which made authorities believe that she had also been bound.
Mm-hmm.
Wilmington investigators then made their way to the Fox home, asking Melissa and Kevin to come down to the station. They had put them in separate rooms when they arrived, and both parents, fearful of what they might hear, waited for almost an hour before they were told that Riley had been found in Forsyth Woods, and they said, quote, she didn't make it.
Oh, my goodness.
Upon hearing the news, Kevin began pounding the walls. Melissa broke down. And in my brain, how can you possibly cope in those moments when you learn that your three-year-old was found dead? I can't fathom that. I can think to the edges that my brain will let me, and it's horrific. And so I just quickly go, nope, we're not thinking about that anymore. Riley's body had been taken to the medical examiner's office where an autopsy was performed. The autopsy revealed that Riley had been sexually assaulted, and her likely cause of death was drowning. A rape kit was conducted, and samples of DNA were collected from Riley's body. These samples were then sent to the Illinois State Police Crime Lab for analysis. And so 5 days after her death, the Foxes held a viewing for Riley, and then the following day they held a funeral. And it was reported that like thousands, I think almost like 6,000 people showed up to mourn the loss of, just like such a sweet little girl.
Right.
Unbeknownst to the Fox family, however, among those in attendance were the Will County detectives videotaping the attendees of the funeral with a sharp focus on Kevin Fox.
Mm-hmm.
Over the course of several weeks after Riley was found murdered, the Fox family cooperated entirely with the investigation and with law enforcement officials. They provided statements, DNA samples, they allowed searches of their home, they did absolutely everything they could to help in the investigation to find out what happened to Riley or who did this to Riley.
Yeah.
So naturally, pretty quickly, Kevin Fox became the prime suspect in the death of his daughter. Kevin had told investigators that he had been the last one to see her alive. They asked that when he could not find Riley that Saturday morning, why did he not immediately call the police? And he simply shared that he didn't want to create a panic in a scene if she had just wandered to a neighbor's house. Right?
I mean, seriously. Yes, especially if... So the last... We've covered a couple of cases where they talk about behavior seeming a little off. You know, they didn't show a lot of emotion, things like that. I have to say, I'm one of those people. I'm not a knee-jerk receiver.
100%. I am too.
I am not a knee-jerk. I don't cry a whole bunch. I cry at odd times. Like, I cry when the In the Arms of the Angel commercial comes on about the dogs, you know? But
sure.
I'm just not a panicky, go ballistic. I'm just like, everything's okay. There's some sort of logical explanation for all of this. So that has caused me to also go through a bit of a personality crisis of like, let me make sure that I respond correctly if I'm ever involved in a crime, because I don't think I respond correctly to stuff.
I'm the same way. Like, I'm always like, let's not panic.
Yeah.
You know, I'm in denial that this is really happening. Yeah. So let's just be calm. We'll figure it out. She's probably next door.
It's going to be okay. So all that to say, I can see why I probably wouldn't call the cops immediately. I would be like, they're probably across the street. They're probably ...
Mm-hmm. And he was just like, I didn't want to raise an alarm prematurely. Sure.
Sure. Yes.
And So Kevin was interviewed over and over and over, and each time he was very open and cooperative with police. However, the detective's focus on Kevin made his family members very uncomfortable. Kevin's brother and his parents eventually urged Kevin to hire an attorney, fearful of the focus that they were seeing placed on Kevin for this investigation.
Yeah.
But Kevin absolutely refused. According to Brian's article, Kevin told his family that if he hired an attorney, he was worried that it might make him look what?
That it would make him look guilty. Mm-hmm. And he had nothing to hide. So
my literal next sentence was, yep, he had nothing to hide.
Again, prior to Dr. K's interview, I would have been the same way. Like, I don't need an attorney. I have nothing to hide. And having him say, like, I don't care. I don't care who you are or what you think you know. Get an attorney.
And Dr. A talks about this whole, like, not, like, looking guilty and how that's kind of like a pressure from law enforcement.
Right.
The family said that Kevin trusted law enforcement implicitly, and he was raised believing law enforcement were good people and the system should be trusted and respected.
For sure. Yeah.
And so, hitting dead ends in the investigation, law enforcement asked for Kevin and Melissa's permission to question their son, Tyler, who was 6 years old at the time. So they were like, hey, your son might have seen something and maybe we can have, you know, a specialist come in and interview him. Is that okay? And they were like, yeah, sure.
Right. Well,
so in late June, Tyler underwent a forensic interview by Mary Jane Pluth, who worked for the Will County Children's Advocacy Center. Mm-hmm. The interview was videotaped per protocol and starts off with basic questions to make sure that Tyler feels comfortable. Lead detective Edward Hayes watches the entire interview from behind the one-way mirror, which, again, is pretty typical.
Mm-hmm.
And so Mary starts asking Tyler about where he lives, what sports does he like,
mm-hmm,
school, that kind of thing. And the questions start to shift to questions about his dad and his sister the night of her disappearance.
Okay.
And so Tyler's just like, I don't know. And Mary's like, did he leave the house? Tyler shakes his head no several times. Once he nods, Mary pursues. What did he do when he left? Did he take Riley somewhere? Tyler just keeps shaking his head. Mary asks again. Tyler says no. And she said, where did he take Riley? You can tell me. And so at this point, Tyler begins totally breaking down. He goes into like a fetal position. He's crying hysterically, asking for his mom and dad. And that's when they stopped the interview. So after the interview ended, Detective Michael Guilfoyle, I don't know if that's how you say your name, sorry, Guilfoyle, he took Tyler back home that afternoon where he continued to question him. Now, this detective is not trained in questioning, interrogating children. Okay. And to top it off, he does this off of camera and off of record.
I don't like it.
We're going to have a lot to say about this, so we're going to write these comments down and we're going to circle back.
Okay.
Detective Guilfoyle would later write up a summary of the interview, noting that Tyler eventually told him that his father, quote, took Riley somewhere during the night, and then he saw his father using the clothes dryer when he got back to the house. Okay.
Okay.
By this point, Kevin Fox has become the prime suspect in the murder of his daughter, Riley.
Yeah, he's public enemy number one.
Mm-hmm. The most compelling piece of evidence that investigators identified came from a surveillance video. Okay, so on top of that, you know, interviewing Tyler, he said he left. So detectives start pulling surveillance videos around the route to Forsyth Woods.
Mm-hmm.
And what they found was a specific video that came from a gas station in town that captured a dark-colored Ford Escape at 4 o'clock in the morning that Riley disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
And this Ford Escape was driving towards Forsyth Woods, right where Riley's body was discovered.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with this, Will County detectives began combing through records of all the locals that owned dark-colored Ford Escapes. Kevin and Melissa Fox owned a dark blue Ford Escape. This just seemed too much to the investigators. If this was the Fox's escape, then it would undermine Kevin's alibi that he was at home asleep at the time of Riley's possible abduction and murder, right?
Okay. Right.
And so things just get worse and worse for Melissa and Kevin. So along with the potential of surveillance evidence of their Ford Escape being caught on camera, rumors began to creep through Wilmington about the fox's involvement and or the strange behaviors the months after Riley's death.
Okay.
So now the town folk are starting to talk.
Yeah.
There had been a Riley fund set up for the Fox family after her death, and the rumors around town said that the Foxes were spending that money on vacations and other luxury items. The Foxes had traded in their blue Ford Escape for a new vehicle. Melissa had gotten a hair makeover. The family went to Las Vegas. And then they went on vacation to the Ozarks.
Okay. Oh, man. That's not looking too good.
Right? And so by October, her disappearance and murder happened at the beginning of June. So by October, investigators believed it was time to formally interrogate Kevin because, according to Will County's spokesperson, Pat Berry, everything that detectives had was still pointing to this guy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So there was nothing to eliminate him at this point.
Right.
So on October 25th, Scott Swearingen, John Rudiger, Michael Guilfoyle, and Edward Hayes all convened at the Will County Sheriff's Office in preparation for Kevin's interrogation.
Mm-hmm.
The detectives contacted several polygraph experts, but none of them were available.
Okay.
So detectives were able to finally find polygrapher Richard C. Williams, a Cook County detective who would facilitate the polygraph during the interrogation.
Okay. Was he a polygraph expert or just somebody who had access to the polygraph?
So the experts that they were trying to find had done thousands in their career. This guy had done 90.
Oh, cool.
Okay.
Cool.
And that's a whole nother bullet point that we're going to bring up too. But yeah, I want to throw you that little bone.
Nice.
So on October 26th, Swearingen contacted Kevin, asking him and Melissa to come down to the station as they had new information about the case. So Melissa and Kevin arrived at the sheriff's office in Joliet around 7:30 that night.
Mm-hmm.
Kevin and Melissa's families had urged them not to go and told them not to talk to the police, that they needed to get an attorney.
Yeah.
Once again, Melissa and Kevin were just like, you know, they've got information about what happened to our baby. We need to find out.
Right.
You know, they're on our side. Because up till this point, investigators had been like super chummy with the Foxes. They've been bending over backwards for them, helping them with this, that, and the other. And they're like, hey, can you come in? We think we have something. And so the Foxes were like, yeah, sure. We'll come down.
And again, y'all, I'm being super vulnerable. That is me. I would be like, sure, yes. And then I would be saying, Lucas, do we need to make cookies for all the people who are working up there tonight? They've worked so hard. We should probably bring them cookies or coffee. I am that personality. I just am. So again, I get that.
Yeah. I think I would be the same. Like, if you need me to come up and answer questions about what happened to my daughter, I 1000% will go.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Sure.
And so the family members were like, y'all, this is weird. This cap, y'all need to know.
Mm-hmm.
But they were desperate to know whatever information they had. And so when they got there, Melissa and Kevin were taken to separate rooms, which is weird if they have information for you.
I mean, I thought it was weird that they separated them in the beginning, but I mean, whatever. So yes, separate rooms. Continue.
And then Kevin began to undergo an interrogation unbeknownst to him initially.
Okay.
So when they meet with him, they're again asking him, like, why did he contact non-emergency line? So what they had found out is when Riley went missing, he didn't call like 911. He called the non-emergency line at the sheriff's office. And he was just like, again, I didn't want to create a panic. It's no big deal. Like, I don't know why that's such a big deal.
Yeah.
Right?
Same. I would have done the same thing.
They then asked Kevin how his son saw him leave the house during the night and then messing with the laundry when he got home. And Kevin didn't have an answer to this because up until this point, the Foxes had no idea that Tyler had been interviewed again by Detective Guilfoyle.
Oh.
They had no idea.
Oh.
So Kevin was totally unaware that his son had made these statements. And he was just like, I don't have an answer for you. This is the first time I've heard of this.
Yeah.
And so he told investigators maybe his son thought he left the house when he had stepped outside to smoke a cigarette.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Reasonable.
And so investigators pressed him about the video evidence of the car. And they're like, hey, this is you in this car. And so Kevin, like, sarcastically was just like, well, then someone must have broken into my house, got the keys, took the vehicle, and then turned it back and left it where it was supposed to be because I didn't leave the house in my car.
Oh, which, I mean, that probably could have happened.
And the officers at that point took that. And again, this is why Dr. K and Dr. A say, like, you need an attorney with you because they can twist your words. They took that as kind of a form of him confessing to leaving the house.
Yeah.
And so in a separate room, so all of this is kind of happening at the same time, Officer Swearingen goes to Melissa and says, hey, we have videotape evidence of this car and we have Tyler's report of what he saw.
Yeah.
And she had never heard of this. This is the first time she's being told about the surveillance video. She's the first time she's told about Tyler being interviewed by Detective Guilfoyle. And she's just like, I don't know what you're talking about.
Right.
And this is where Officer Swearingen gives her a version of an accidental death scenario. Okay.
Okay.
He's like, so this is, Melissa, this is what's happened. We think that Kevin might have accidentally hit Riley, accidentally dropped her on her head, and then he panicked. He didn't mean to kill her. He didn't think that she was going to die from it. But he panicked, and so he dropped her off and discarded her body in the woods. He was like, he duct taped her mouth and then sexually assaulted his own daughter to make it look like it had been an abduction. And Melissa was like, no.
Yeah.
No.
No way.
She was like, Kevin is amazing. He's a great dad. There's absolutely no way that this is making sense.
No.
Okay? But she also doesn't know what's going on, and she doesn't know that, you know, what evidence they might have that she doesn't,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And so after hours and hours of interrogation, investigators finally began to be more directly accusing of Kevin in the murder of his daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now, this next couple of paragraphs, you guys, is going to be pretty, it can be pretty triggering. It can be kind of overwhelming, but we'll roll through it. And so they told him the only thing that he could do to persuade them that he didn't do it was to what, Chelsea?
Take a lie detector test or give
uh-huh.
samples, right? Like DNA samples.
Well, he's already given a DNA sample.
Okay.
And so they were like, the only way that you're going to prove to us that you didn't do it is to take a polygraph. And
right.
So Kevin's like, I don't have anything to hide. I'll take a polygraph.
Yeah.
And so he agreed. And so now it's about 12:20 in the morning, now October 27th, and he underwent a polygraph test. He was told if he passed, he would be cleared as a suspect, and if he failed, he would be charged with murder. Which, just so you guys know, that's not exactly how it works. Polygraphs cannot be used in court. It's just a tool that can help investigators try to hone in on a person, but you cannot use polygraphs in court.
I was just about to say, I was like, I'm not very savvy in this, but I feel like that's cap. I feel like that's not correct.
That's cap for sure.
That's cap.
So after about an hour, detectives told Kevin that he, what, do you want to guess?
He failed it, dude.
He failed it.
You were killed and sexually assaulted your daughter, and we're going to put your sorry butt behind bars and you can rot there.
Mm-hmm. So according to Brian Smith's article, the polygrapher turned to Kevin and said, you did it. It's all right to say you did it. Across the station, investigators told Melissa that Kevin failed his polygraph, and the polygrapher, because she was like, I don't believe you.
Mm-hmm.
And so they showed her the results and they said, see all that red? That's failed. Okay.
Yes.
So Kevin was taken back to the interrogation room, and all this time he was just like, I didn't do this. And he's telling his wife, he was like, I swear on everything. I swear to God, I did not do this. I didn't hurt Riley. And she's just like, this is crazy.
Right.
And so they take Kevin back to an interrogation room, and he was instructed to fill out an arrest sheet for first-degree murder. Detective Guilfoyle began banging the handcuffs on the table in front of Kevin, and Ed Hayes was saying to him, you don't have much time. If I finish this sheet, you are being charged with first-degree murder with 30 years to life. Hayes leaned into Kevin and said that he knew people in the jail and would make sure that Kevin was, quote, fucked every day unless he told the investigators what they wanted to hear.
So I am going to strongly encourage you guys who are listening to listen to Dr. A's interview, because you will get to hear the sobering story of what I did one time. And literally, it gives you a great perspective of how easy it is to do things that you would not think that you would normally do. Like, mm-hmm. keep a very open mind on all parties in this story.
Yeah. And it was reported in the same article that Rüdiger straddled Kevin's legs, pressing his testicles into Kevin's knees, grabbed the back of Kevin's shirt, pulled his face close, and said, "Your family doesn't love you, so just say you did it." So finally,
Was this all reported, Bailey? Oh, gosh.
I'll get there.
Make me very uncomfortable.
So wanting to get an emotional response from Kevin, the investigators pull out pictures of Riley from the crime scene. They show pictures of her that the crime scene techs took just moments after pulling her out of the water. She was deceased. She still had duct tape on her mouth, and she was nude from the waist down. Detective Guilfoyle said, "Riley is in the room with you right now. She is in pain and needs closure." Can you fucking imagine, as a parent, sitting there and they're showing you pictures of your child saying, "You did this. She needs pain, or she's in pain. She needs closure." And the only thing you want to do is to have your daughter back. You want to rescue her. You want to take all the pain away. You don't want this to be happening, right?
Right.
And at this time, Swearengen says that he just spoke with the DA, Jeffrey Tomczak, and said to Kevin that he can help you if you act now. Okay. He said that DA Tomczak will make him a deal with a confession. Swearengen then gave Kevin the same accident scenario that he gave to Melissa and told Kevin, "It's now or never. Say it was an accident. Get your help from the state's attorney so you can go home to your family. If you pass it up, you will spend your life in prison. If you say it was an accident, it's involuntary manslaughter with a 3 to 5 year sentence. You'll serve half, and then you'll go home now on bond."
This is, I did not order this plate of food. So sorry. I need to speak to a manager.
Please. Well, this would be a great time for a Karen to pop in and be like, "You can't do this. You can't do that.
I need to speak to a manager because I did not order this plate of food, Bailey. I don't even know how to digest this stuff."
Mm-hmm. I'm lactose intolerant. Have you seen all those posts with people being like bon appetit, like bone apple teeth and shit? Like, people don't know how it's spelled. So lactose and tolerant.
Yes.
Okay. So by this point, it's 6 a.m. in the morning. Kevin has been interrogated for nearly 12 hours. He's been up for over 24 hours and running on essentially no food and is becoming disoriented. Kevin, at this point, he plays the terms of the offer over and over in his head. He maintained his innocence, but then thought if he could just get out on bond, he could straighten this mess out. Dr. A literally talks about this exact scenario.
Yes. Yes.
So Kevin agreed to share his confession. So at 8:30 that morning on October 27th, the video camera was now turned on.
No, I don't like it.
To tape Kevin's confession. According to the Will County Sheriff's Department, Kevin's confession detailed what happened to Riley.
I really want to hear this confession, actually. Let me hear
this
confession.
It's bad. Hashtag triggering. Okay. So this is how it goes. He said that he and the kids arrived home around 1:30 in the morning. He put them to sleep. He had a snack. He watched some TV and an adult video, went to bed. He went to the bathroom about 2:15 and didn't know that Riley had awoken, and he said that he swung the bathroom door open and it hit her in the head, knocking her down. Now, this is what Kevin is confessing in this interrogation.
Right. Okay.
At this point, he said Riley appeared unresponsive, so he thought she was dead. He panicked. He picked her up, carried her to his car, and got some duct tape.
He said that in his state of panic, he thought about taking her either to the hospital or his in-laws' house, but then decided to make her death look like an accident and an abduction. So he said he duct taped Riley's mouth and hands. He drove her to Forsyth Creek. Before leaving her there, he placed a finger inside of her to make it look like she had been sexually assaulted. He said he made his way back home, cried, and then went to sleep.
Okay, so that was what he said happened after hours of being grilled.
Right. And so what about the DNA found inside the vaginal cavity? You don't get that kind of DNA from a finger, officers. Okay, just so everyone's super clear.
No.
Okay. So the Will County Sheriff's detectives had gotten what they wanted. He confessed to not only killing his child, but sexually assaulting her as an elaborate cover-up. Kevin was then taken to booking. His mugshot was taken. He was fingerprinted and left in a jail cell to start the process of being charged with killing his daughter. What Kevin soon learns is that he wasn't getting bonded out as he told. He wasn't being booked for involuntary manslaughter, like he was told. He was being charged with first-degree murder, and that carried the possibility of the death penalty.
Oh. When my daughter was really little, for whatever reason, she said OMI instead of OMG. So that is now a staple in our house. So that's my response to this whole situation.
OMI. So Kevin sat there in jail with the enormous weight of the reality of what he was facing, and that began to sink in. So when Kevin was arrested, Melissa was told that he was being charged with Riley's murder and that he had confessed. Melissa was like, no, nope, I don't care what you say. She said even if Kevin had accidentally hurt Riley, he would have tried to resuscitate her because he was CPR certified. She was like, why would he have not revived her?
Right.
And the rest of Kevin's family was just like, no. And so in a beautiful twist of fate, by happenstance, Chad, who is Kevin's brother, worked in an office across the hall from a lawyer by the name of Kathleen Zellner.
Okay.
Chad spoke with Kathleen about what was happening to Kevin, and Kathleen, who had been following this case very closely, agreed to help the Fox family. She believed in Chad's sincerity because when Chad had met with Kevin behind, like in the jail, he was like, I am 1,000% convinced that he did not do this.
Right.
And so I put in here, can we just thank God for people like Kathleen Zellner? Because y'all are going to see how amazing she is.
I was literally thinking the same thing where it's like, thank you for being there and having the willingness to say, this isn't sitting well with me.
Yeah. So Kathleen hit the ground running, dude. She hit the ground running trying to prove Kevin's innocence. Shortly after, Kevin's bond was set at $25 million.
Oh my God.
And people were just like, this doesn't make any sense.
Seriously. I'm like, $25 million American dollars?
Yeah. What? Not Monopoly money. Yeah. Kathleen encouraged the Fox family to use that money to help with the investigation rather than trying to pay to get him out on bond. She was like, I'm sorry about it, Kevin, you have to understand, but if that money's going to go further, if you have to sit and wait in jail and don't use it on bond, I'm sorry, but just trust me. And so they listened to her and he sat in jail while she figured all this stuff out.
What a boss.
Dude, she gets better. Just wait. So Kathleen was up against a whole small town ignorance, likely political corruption, officers that were sloppy, totally negligent in the investigation, all of it. And I just bulleted this because I was like, this is going to turn into a 48-page thesis. Okay. So some of the things that she found. Number one, until the night of Kevin's interrogation, authorities never told him about Tyler's interview by Detective Guilfoyle. Okay. Uh-huh. When she found out about it, she requested the summary, and the Will County authorities told her they were gone. Couldn't find them.
I bet this is in the same box with the choice,
yes.
All of her stuff. Like, there is a box, and all of the
it's called,
quote,
na-na-na, our dirty little secrets. That's what it's called.
No joke.
So number two, 3 days after Kevin's arrest, Jeffrey Tomczak, remember good old Jeffrey Tomczak, gave a press conference. Here, he told the Chicago Tribune that they believed they had the right guy. There was evidence found in their investigation that Riley had been sexually abused in her lifetime. Not just found that way, but a history of it. However, Riley's pediatrician stated and was willing to sign an affidavit that there was never any evidence of this. And so it prompted a full CPS investigation and yielded zero results of sexual abuse.
Oh,
number three. Number three, regarding the polygraph, the results were actually inconclusive. So remember I told you he did 90 tests compared to the experts who had done thousands.
Right.
Okay. And they had, so Kathleen actually talked to some of these experts and they were like, I wouldn't have given him a polygraph at that time anyways, because of the, like, the state that he was in.
I was going to say because of his physical or emotional or mental state.
Right.
Yeah.
Number four, Jeffrey Tomczak was running for state attorney's office. The interrogation of Kevin happened 4 days before the race, and the break in Riley Fox's case would have helped his chance of winning. On top of that, Jeffrey Tomczak's dad, Donald, the DA's father, had just been arrested on federal indictment for a hired truck scandal in Chicago.
So they had some good news on their side of the fence.
Number five, remember those weird rumors about the Fox family, about their spending and all of that stuff?
Oh, yeah, they were like gallivanting around and all their money.
Turns out Melissa traded in the car because she couldn't bear to drive that around because it reminded her of trips around town with Riley. Valid.
Valid.
The Las Vegas trip was to attend a friend's wedding and had been planned and paid for months before Riley's disappearance and death.
Yeah.
The trip to the Ozarks had been for another friend's wedding, so there was no lavish spending on any fun family vacations. Okay. Other things to consider. First, under Illinois law, promising a suspect leniency to confess is forbidden. Can't do it.
Say that one more time or explain that real quick.
Promising a suspect, so like Kevin, leniency, like, hey, it'll just be manslaughter.
Oh, okay.
In order to get them to confess was against the law. You could not do that.
Okay. Gotcha.
Detectives denied that they did that. And since all of that was not on video, and fun fact, this law had not yet gone into effect for the interrogation to be recorded. So it was Kevin's word against theirs.
Right.
The more Kathleen dug into this case, the more she was just like, what in the actual Mad Max is going on? Okay. The more shit she found. She was like, essentially, this whole thing is a shit show.
Right.
The biggest thing is she struggled to comprehend why a father with CPR training made no attempt to revive his daughter.
Right.
First question. Second question. Why was no duct tape found in the search if Kevin did it? There was no duct tape found in his car.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Good point.
Number three. If he slipped in the mud, why were his clothes not muddy? And there was no evidence that the, like, they took meters readings from the washing machine and everything and it hadn't been run. Okay, so that wasn't a thing. He didn't wash his clothes.
Yep.
How could a lightweight bathroom door knock a little girl out so completely that she appeared dead?
Right.
Why was there no blood or any other physical evidence found in the Ford escape?
None.
Right. And most telling, how could detectives ignore that Kevin had not provided a single piece of information that only the killer would have known? Like, where are her capri pants? Where is her underwear? Where's anything like that?
Right.
And so finally, she began looking into the element that seemed to have been forgotten, which was the DNA evidence. Okay. At a hearing in January 28th of 2005, so he was arrested in end of October. This is now January.
Okay.
Will County prosecutors turned over several police reports to Zellner and her defense team. As for the long-awaited DNA evidence originally taken from Riley, the news was not good for Kevin. The little girl's rape kits had not contained sufficient genetic material to yield as usable results, so inconclusive.
Oh, no.
What Zellner didn't know about the DNA testing was that the FBI had not tested Riley's DNA.
What?
The day after the election, an order had come from the Will County Sheriff's Office halting any testing of DNA evidence in the Riley Fox case.
What?
Do you want to guess who ordered this?
Was it the DA?
Ed Hayes, the detective that was part of Kevin's interrogation.
Oh, gosh.
Okay. So Kathleen Zellner, being a bad bitch that she is, was like, no. What does this mean? What does inconclusive mean? So she called up a forensic scientist buddy and was just like, hey, what does this mean? And they were like, oh, yeah, that doesn't mean it's inconclusive. That just means the lab that it was sent to did not have the sophisticated capabilities needed to properly test the DNA.
Well, do they still have the DNA? Do they still have it in a vial somewhere?
Being a badass, a mega badass that she is, she got a court order to have the DNA tested in a private lab. And on June 7th, 2005, so this is almost a year later, almost to the day,
yeah,
the results were in. Kevin Fox was not a match. Not even close. So 9 days later, in a packed courtroom, the state's attorney argued that since the DNA excluded Kevin Fox, all charges should be dismissed. I mean,
correct.
Yes.
That is... it's like Chris Farley. That is correct.
And so the judge agreed. And so Kevin was finally released as a free man, proven innocent of his daughter's murder and assault. He hugged his wife and son, shaking with tears over the whole ordeal. He had been in jail for 8 months, lost 20 pounds, was mercilessly judged as a member by members of his community,
yeah,
because everybody believed him to be this sick, twisted monster who molested and killed his daughter.
I mean, again, if somebody says, sure, I did it, you really can't blame people for taking him at his quote-unquote word, right?
Yeah, but this is my favorite part about his petty Betty family, is whenever he and his wife left the courtroom and walked out to the crowd of onlookers, there were like 100 people in the crowd wearing t-shirts that said test before arrest.
Wow. Yes.
So Kathleen and the family made all of these t-shirts that was just like test before arrest.
Oh, that gives me chills. I love that so much.
Mm-hmm. All right. So now I'm sure everybody's wondering if this is where the story ends.
Well, no, we can't end it unless we talk about why did he confess? Why did he say all this stuff?
Well, this is not where the story ends because we still have to find out what happened.
Oh, that's true. Crap. Yeah. Whose DNA was it? I'm so focused in on Kevin Fox that I forgot about the actual perpetrator.
Yeah. So police tested the DNA found in Riley against every male in the Fox family, as well as numerous people in the neighborhood, including several previously convicted sex offenders.
Mm-hmm.
But there was nothing. There were no hits or matches with this effort and no luck for about 5 years.
Oh, snap.
But in 2000, so 5 years after this happened, so this is now 2009, Special Agent Lori Warren with the FBI began working on what she called the most important case in my career. Warren and her team brought new energy to the investigation that had gone totally cold.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. She wanted to bring Riley's killer to justice.
Mm-hmm.
So, years into the investigation, she came across a lead. During the FBI's canvas, by this point, again in 2010, agents spoke with a woman named Trisha Kiefer, who gave them a name of Scott Ebby, with whom she'd been in a previous relationship.
Okay.
The FBI learned that Ebby was someone with a lengthy rap sheet who had been in and out of prison for burglary and other felonies. At the time of Riley's murder, he was living with his mama in Wilmington, a mile from the Fox's home.
Okay.
Outlined in an ABC article by Smith, Diaz, Rivas, and Yang, according to this woman, months after Riley's funeral, she and Ebby were at Riley's Memorial Garden when she said, I can't believe somebody did that to that sweet little girl. And he said, oh, that was such a shame, wasn't it? And she said the way he said it was cold,
yeah,
like he didn't mean it. She
right.
said it was like an actor reading from a script. And she said for some reason it just stuck in her head.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't much to go on, but Warren decided to chase this lead and she wanted to talk to Ebby. Well, she had to go to Lawrence Correctional Center, where he was currently imprisoned, for do you want to guess what?
probably some sort of like domestic violence or sexual assault or something.
Sexual assault.
EB was apparently cooperative with the FBI during their questioning. He insisted he didn't know the foxes, didn't know any information about the case. He had only heard about it because it was a big national news case.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently this visit from the FBI set a domino effect in motion that would bring many answers to long-held questions of what actually happened to Riley.
Mm-hmm.
Days later, after Warren interviewed him, she gets a call from the prison. And they're like, yo, Special Agent Warren, we just want to let you know that EB tried to commit suicide. And he left a letter in his cell titled, A Confession to Murder.
Oh.
So it outlined his confessions against what he did to Riley Fox.
Oh.
So after obtaining a warrant to get his DNA, Agent Warren returned to the prison to speak with him and on record to get his confession. And she got what she hoped for. So you guys buckle in. This is graphic and it sucks. So on the evening of June 6, 2004, EB shared that he was drunk and high on cocaine and planned to rob some houses. Because what else do you do to have fun?
Right.
That night, he had broken into a house across the street from the Fox's home. That house, he stole $40 from a wallet, then stopped by the Fox's house. He said that the back door to the Fox's home was broken and he was able to just walk in. While he was inside the home, he looked for valuables to steal, didn't see anything. And according to that same ABC News article, EB said, quote, I was getting ready to leave and I looked back and I don't know, for some reason, I just fixated on that little girl. He continued that he took Riley to Forsyth Woods, where he eventually sexually assaulted her in the park's bathroom. He initially didn't plan to kill her, per his report. But his face bandana slipped off and it revealed his face and she saw him. So he began to panic when Riley, she started begging and crying that she wanted her daddy.
Oh, gosh.
And EB told the FBI that is when he decided to drown her in the creek. And that's what he did. So he walked down to the creek, drowned her, threw his sneakers into the creek and left. Okay. Couple things to note. Number one, there was a burglary in a house across the street the same night Riley went missing. Why was that not explored? Now, this is going to blow your mind. This is going to blow everybody's mind. What Agent Warren learned absolutely rocked her socks. She learned that the Will County Sheriff's Office had both of EB's shoes in their custody, with his name written on the tongues of the shoes from the day that Riley was found.
I really think that we need to start rethinking how we do these cases, because I either need to get better at how I can respond to this stuff, or you need to give me time to process this stuff so I can actually give a response, because I am catching myself more and more with the literal response is, I have no words.
I think that's pretty normal, though. I think that's normal.
What in the actual flip is
they had
on?
EB shoes.
They had his shoes.
Fucking names written on the tongues, like he is in sixth grade, and his mom's like, write your name on your shoes so you don't lose them. And he's like, okay, mom. And during his confession, he was like, yeah, I expected authorities to find me a lot sooner because my name was literally written on the shoes that I left at the crime scene.
At this point, I would not be surprised if it also said on those shoes or stuffed in those shoes was a piece of paper that said, hi, my name is EB. This is my address. I killed this little girl. Catch you on the flip side. XOXO.
Yeah.
You know, like that would not surprise me at this point.
So it gets worse.
Oh, I spoke too soon.
What's wild is that Melissa, she had even shared that she recalled that investigators literally asked her what size shoe Kevin wore. And she told him, and they didn't match the shoe size from the creek. They didn't tell her that, but they're like, yo, your hubs, what size shoes does he wear? And she's like, you know, like a 10 or whatever,
yeah.
10 and a half. And they were like, ah, cool.
Yeah,
and then they went back and checked the shoes with like some dude's name in them, and they're like, "Ah, these aren't Kevin's shoes." Like, what are you doing? Like, even if they were the same size, like, Bro literally had his name
had his
written
name
in the
in
shoes.
it. Had his name in the permanent marker in the tunnels. I mean, come on.
And so what's even more is she found out that Wilmington police visited Scott Eby's house in the hours following Riley's disappearance. Police officers were doing a welfare check because his friend called the police after saying he was suicidal.
Mm-hmm.
So they show up to his house. This is the day that this little girl goes missing. And as soon as he opens the door and sees them, he immediately starts throwing up. Like, immediately starts throwing up and then said, "Have you found the little girl yet?" And the cops were like, "Oh, no, but we just wanted to check on you. We found your shoes." I'm not trying to make this, like, funny, but I just cannot, you guys. I cannot. And so he's like, "No, I'm fine. Obviously, I'm not suicidal." And they were like, "I cool." So Kathleen, this attorney, right? She's just like, if the investigators had only run his name through the system, what would they have found? Well, so glad you asked, Chelsea. They would have found a criminal history that possibly tied him to Riley. He had a history of burglaries and other felonies, suicide attempts, and lots of things, right? He was not a great dude.
Yeah.
Okay. And so in 2010, the then sheriff of the Will County Sheriff's Department, Sheriff Paul Coppice, admitted his department, quote, obviously dropped the ball, quote, and commissioned an outside review to see what mistakes were made during its handling of the Riley Fox case. And the author, Bill Andrews, was just like, I'll tell you what the review said. And it was scathing. It said, quote, well-intentioned, if overzealous investigators ignored or were unaware of substantial leads and information that may have led them to very different conclusions. The report further outlined the flawed investigation, including their then-current practice of conducting interviews, administering polygraphs, and recording confessions. Bill Andrews further went on to say, I think the primary reason they believed that Kevin Fox was responsible, ultimately, was that he was all they had. So 5 months into the case, they decided to make a run at him, but not because there was overwhelming or even remotely convincing evidence that he had done anything wrong. So finally, 6 years after Riley's abduction, assault, and murder in 2010, Scott Eby was charged with first-degree murder and predatory sexual assault. He pleaded guilty and was sentenced to life in prison without parole. Melissa and Kevin Fox were both there for his sentencing and read victim impact statements. Melissa said to Eby, I came to face you so you would know how important standing up for Riley was to me. She was defenseless that night, and that makes you a coward and a monster.
Yeah.
According to an article by Harrington at Team ABC News, Kevin shared his impact statement saying, I still can't believe that people thought I was the monster in front of me now. You deserve everything that is handed to you. From the time you killed Riley, I changed for the worst. I built up a lot of depression, and that depression turned to hate, which affected a lot of people in my life. And so after Scott was convicted, Melissa and Kevin moved their family out of Wilmington to a small town called Naperville. They shared that moving to a new place feels like it gave them a new start. Kevin said, I used to love it, talking about his hometown, but I lost so much there. The only reason I go back now is to visit Riley Stone.
Oh, goodness. Oh, man.
And so, couple of things to touch base on. The Fox family pushed for the passage of Riley's Law, which was a measure that would expedite DNA testing after child murders. In his 2007 budget, Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich included a similar initiative that would add 8 forensic scientists to the state's crime lab. In 2009, the Foxes were initially awarded $15 million for the false arrest and intentional infliction of emotional distress.
Yeah.
And the Foxes ended up getting about half of that from the settlement.
Right.
Scott Eby died in prison on December 7th, 2023, at the age of 52.
Mm-hmm.
And for the last
kind of saddest update. Sorry to bust everybody's bubble. According to Trey Ward, several years ago, Kevin Fox was killed in a head-on collision in Arkansas, and he was instantly killed at the scene. So him and the other driver passed away. And so that is the really, really sad and horrific, awful, sucky, shitty story of the abduction, assault, and murder of sweet, precious little baby Riley Fox.
Oh, man. That really was not very, there's not a lot of redeeming qualities to that case. Okay, though, I am the one thing, and maybe I'm just doing this selfishly to make me feel better about stuff. I just finished reading an article talking about essentially this idea of burnout or compassion burnout, things like that. And talking about how people in the medical field are showing more and more, having more and more reviews and ratings that are lower or dropped. You know, patients are saying that they are unhappy with their care, things like that. And they've been researching it. And they're finding that so many of these medical providers are under so much stress and so much reimbursement issues and insurance stuff that their compassion is kind of dropping because they are just burnt out. They don't have the help that they need or whatever it is. So I say all of that to say, sometimes I wonder if fields like law enforcement, because of staffing issues, because of, and I'm not saying that it's justifiable. I'm just trying to look at, were these staff members, had they seen so many cases that they were just like, yeah, it probably was the dad, just like in this case, just like in that case, kind of carrying that, again, unconscious or even conscious bias with them. And therefore, because they are just so burnt out that they're slipping and not following protocol and things like that.
I love that you always try to give the benefit of the doubt. It's one thing I love about you so much.
Yes, I know.
I mean, yeah, sure. Could it be burnout?
Mm-hmm.
Yep, it could. My argument to that is, if you're burnt out, then fucking do something about it.
I know.
Like, I got burnt out being a trauma therapist, doing what, trauma and addiction work every day, you know, 40 hours a week for years. And I was like, I need to take a little break. So then I took a little break. And now I do a much different type of job. I still dabble in that for sure. I mean, I'm still in that arena, but I'm not, you know, private practice was a lot of hard work. And so is inpatient. So I had to make decisions to do something for myself. And just a couple of things. Like, one of the points that I wanted to bring up is, as far as like false confessions, one of the things that Kevin mentioned, you know, and there's a lot of like interviews with the Fox family afterwards and stuff. And one of the things he said was like, it happened so quickly and it didn't seem to make much sense. One thing he said was, I felt tricked. I felt tricked by law enforcement. Yeah. I felt tricked into this.
Right.
And so like a lot of experts on interrogation and false confessions, they say that that's not uncommon, that a lot of people, you know, will make these confessions and then they feel tricked. So one study that I found was Northwestern University School of Law's Center on Wrongful Convictions. They report that 60% of the 42 wrongful murder convictions since 1970 in Illinois have rested in whole or in part false confessions. So 60% of the wrongful convictions in Illinois since 1970 have rested entirely or in part on false confessions.
Wow.
So more than half of these wrongful convictions were because people falsely confessed.
Yeah.
Right? And Kevin would not have known this. He wouldn't have known the statistics. He wouldn't have known the theories of interrogation techniques or anything like that.
Right.
And this is why Dr. A and Dr. K talk so much about getting an attorney, because an attorney would have been there in Kevin's case and been like, no, we're not doing a polygraph. You have no evidence. There's no circumstantial evidence. There's nothing. There's nothing. He doesn't need to do a polygraph.
Correct. Correct. Yes.
And so, you know, and we can also talk about how this kid was interviewed by the detectives.
Right.
Without the parents' consent.
Right.
Do you know how pissed off I would be if somebody interviewed my child in a murder investigation and they didn't tell me about it?
Yeah, well, if they interviewed your child, she would call him a booby. And then be like, then she'd go tell Zach on him.
And she'd say no, because that's her favorite word.
She'd say no, call him a booby, and then go find her dad and tattle on law enforcement.
The other thing is during that interview with Tyler, the son, by the end, he had answered no. He said the words no approximately 178 times.
Yeah. Man,
So there's some thoughts for you on that.
I think I want to selfishly, I've said the word selfishly quite a bit this episode. I think I want to reiterate the fact that I am, and I think I can speak for Bailey. I think you guys have heard this with Bailey. We are very pro law enforcement. We are pro the court systems. Like, we are pro these things. We are not pro faulty, right? So faulty law.
We're pro good.
We are
anti bad.
Correct. So we are not saying that law enforcement is bad or that our judicial system is bad. We are saying, again, like you will hear with Dr. A and Dr. K, we are saying that it needs to be brought to light that mistakes or bad practice can happen. And we need to educate ourselves and others that that can happen and what you should do to right those wrongs, to bring it back into a good standing. So I just really want to be very, very, very clear to our listeners who are like, it seems like you guys are just ragging on police all the time. Again, we are not anti any of those things. We are pro justice, pro protocol, pro the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we also hate all of you guys equally if you guys aren't doing the right thing. Does that make sense? Am I making
sense?
I just wanted to be very clear on that.
Yeah. And so this will be a good reason for you guys to listen to Dr. A's interview and how she talks so much about, like, it can happen to you.
Mm-hmm.
It can happen to you.
Really,
even if you think it can't happen to you, it can happen to you. False confessions happen all the time. There's different types of false confessions. And
there's a whole science behind why people falsely confess. Like, again, it's something that more than likely you, the lay person, is not going to understand. I didn't understand. Like, not saying that I'm by any means this very relevant or extremely smart person, but as much as Bailey and I explore these things, there were things that we were blown away over with this idea of false confession. So again, yes, we are true crime genre, but we are also educational, and we want you guys to be educated. If you are ever in a pickle like this,
get an attorney.
Know your rights.
Don't take a lie detector test.
You need to ask questions. It's okay to be quote unquote not nice
or uncooperative
or quote unquote uncooperative.
That's well, okay. I wouldn't even say that. Just get an attorney.
Yeah.
The first words out of your mouth, if you find yourself in a police station, should be, I want an attorney.
I want to talk to my attorney.
If you cannot afford one, one will be presented for you.
Correct. So. I want an attorney. And it does not matter. I do not care how innocent you are. So
get an attorney. So that is the, I don't like doing child cases. I just think.
I know.
Because they're just so sweet and so young and so innocent. I don't like bringing this stuff back up.
Nice.
But I also think it's important. And I think it's every parent's kind of like nightmares to be accused of something that goes wrong with your child, right? So it's definitely relevant.
It definitely is. I think one other thing that I thought of when listening to this case is how you, Bailey, have said, I've heard you say time and time again, sober that person might not do this. but a person under the influence.
Oh, you know, that's a really good point, because I was thinking to myself the other day, and I'm still trying to get in touch with people who specialize in like violent crime and psychopathy and stuff like that, and even like sex offender populations. I was wondering if, you know, because people, at least my take on people who throw up when presented with something like some disturbing information, it's usually like a full kind of nervous system, like that's, you know, they're completely disgusted. And so I wonder if people who do stuff like that when they're altered already have that propensity or tendency, or if people, because at least from my perspective, it's not something that just kind of comes up just because you're using, it's usually something that's already there.
Correct. Yes.
But maybe you wouldn't have acted on it if you weren't that intoxicated. I don't know, but I just found that an interesting piece of that.
Yeah.
That can be a question for another day. So,
yeah.
All right. Well, I want to put a nice bow on this box if we can, because that was not fun, but necessary for what we're talking about.
It was definitely interesting. And I have to say, I'm really thankful for those bad bosses out there, man, who get boots on the ground and do some good work. So thanks for that.
So make sure to tune in Friday for Dr. A and Lauren's interview.
Yeah, you guys will love it. We promise.
Okay. Thanks a lot for hanging out with us through this wild and crazy ride.
Yep. And we will catch you on the flip side.
Bye, guys.
Later, Gators.
Hey, Wildside Tribe. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Wildside Podcast. Make sure to tune in on Wildside Wednesdays. New episodes will drop each Wednesday at 6 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. We would love to hear from you. So if you have a wild case recommendation, email us at wildsidepodcast@gmail.com. That's wildside with a C. Or share your thoughts in the comments below. As always, if you haven't heard it today, you're loved, you're worthy, and you're valuable. And we'll catch you on
the flip side.